The following program is pre-recorded. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jerry Pippin's UFO Show. And we have some good UFO programming coming up here. A very interesting interview about Eisenhower meeting ETs on the runway at Holloman Air Force Base. Also, we have another abduction story, one that'll keep you on the edge of your chair, and something about crop circles and UFOs. But first, let's do a little bit of a different thing. We're all familiar with the Tucson shooting and the shooter. Lots of information about him. But we thought we would present a segment from our conspiracy show that I think you'll find interesting. It's about 8 or 9 minutes long. Then we'll get to the UFOs. Listen. The Tucson Massacre, an alternative theory. In this segment, we're going to present a look at the details of the killing of U.S. federal judge John Roll and the grave injury of Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, along with the injury of 13 other people. You've heard all the controversy by now, how this happened, when it happened, the political blame game. Is it the conservatives' fault? Is it actually liberals who did it? On and on. Conspiracies are abounding. Speaking of conspiracies, since we do conspiracy shows, I thought it was time for us to examine exactly what is happening here. Let's talk about a few of the internet conspiracies, and actually there are other places as well. Speculation that the federal judge, Judge Roll, was called and asked to appear so that he could be killed. We have taken some time to examine some of his findings and some of his trials and some of his court cases, and we must say most of the rumors that we read as fact are not facts at all. At least, they're not evident. There are all kinds of rumors that the military and other people, such as the CIA and other units, have access to these abilities to control one's mind. Others say that the only mind control going on was hateful speech of radio talk show host candidates running for office, and even some blame has been put on former political vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin for her listing the congresswoman as a target in her gun sight on her website. John Kelly, a Canadian who you probably know if you listen to our shows over the years, has specialized in backward speech and other techniques, and actually trying to figure out what people are really saying. Are there hidden meanings that we're not even aware of ourselves? He's entered the fray now with a segment of his internet television show, and it's centered around a video that was released by the community college in Tucson. By now you know that Jared Lochner was suspended by Pima Community College 3 months ago. They released the video to the Los Angeles Times, the video that was responsible for suspension, they say, plus some erratic behavior in the classroom, not once, but at least 5 times. Is there a clue on this video about why he showed up at the Safeway store that morning and committed mayhem? We're going to play part of that audio, of that track of that video, as Jared is walking through the campus with the video rolling. His commentary and reality seem to be far, far different from what other people think about that college. Listen carefully to the commentary. We're going to pick it up here as he's walking by. He happens to encounter one of his instructors, stating, "I lost my freedom of speech to that guy, and this is what happens, and I'm in a terrible place. This is the school that I go to."
All right, so here's what we're doing. We're examining the torture of students. We are looking at students who have been tortured. Their low-income pay in two wars. The war that we are in right now is currently illegal under the Constitution. What makes it illegal is the currency. date is also mine. It's impossible for me to be that date. It's mind control. How's it going? Thanks for the bee. I'm pissed off. I lost my freedom of speech to that guy. And this is what happens. And I'm in a terrible place.
John Kelly has made quite a reputation on reverse speech, playing things backwards and running it through certain filters, and coming up with other things that people are saying other than what is obvious. And he has dealt with this videotape that's been released by the Community College in Tucson to the L.A. Times, and now everybody has it, including us. And let's listen to John Kelly explain what he thinks is happening here. I'm not endorsing his conspiracy theory at all, but I do think it's worth listening. Here is John from today's Secret Messages TV show.
Played in reverse, the secret message says, a gun shoots the mute. The walkthrough continues into the school cafeteria.
And then here's the microwave that I'll be using when I'm homeless. This is the cafeteria, the illegal transactions.
Through the audio mirror filter, the secret message says, gonna load guns and kill.
Listen to how John Kelly lays out his idea of the conspiracy.
According to the event timeline, on September 23rd, 2010, there was an involuntary statement of unconscious intent. Suspected shooter Jared Lochner records video soundtrack on Pima College campus containing predictive messages describing a gun shoots the mute and gonna load guns and kill. November 30th, 2010, purchase of weapon. Lochner legally purchased the Glock at a Sportsman's Warehouse chain store in Tucson, Arizona, on November 30th after completing a form and passing a background check. January 8, 2011, MKUltra mass political assassination and ritual murder in Tucson, Arizona. Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is gravely wounded along with 13 others. Six people are killed, including a U.S. federal judge and a 9-year-old girl. This is the Secret Message Report, headline edition. I'm John Kelly.
Is John Kelly correct? Was this an incident of mind control? Jared Lochner controlled from afar by some strange weapon? Or was it mind control from the media? Or could it be that Lochner was just unhappy? And everywhere he looked, he saw things that were not as they should be. And he took it into his own hands to make his point. Listen carefully to what Lochner has to say.
This is Pima Community College, one of the biggest scams in America. The students are so illiterate that it affects their daily lives.
We live in a strange time. Fish dying, birds dying by the hundreds of thousands. A man named Wheeler, who worked in biological weapons, turns up in a trash dump in Delaware. Did he know too much? And then Jared Lochner shows up in front of the Safeway and opens fire. What really is going on? Unfortunately, we don't have the answers, but we'll keep trying to find them. This has been a special report on the Jerry Pippen Show. At JerryPippen.com, we have a whole section on conspiracies, by the way. And we're deep in the heart of a 9/11 series, which we are going to bring right up to the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And we have some pretty interesting witnesses. A couple of shows in February. One of them presents a lady who worked for the CIA in the Bush administration, who was actually thrown in jail under the Patriot Act before she could get out. They tried to say she had some mental problems. And all of this was because she was ready to tell some of the details about 9/11 from the administration standpoint, and what she says is not pretty. That'll be on our website starting in February, and it will be on demand as usual. Everything we have is a podcast, MP3, or for you PC users, Windows Media versions.
Jim Mars on 9/11.
It's kind of a consensus that, well, you know, if we use the ability to electronically capture airplanes and fly them by remote control against the wishes of anybody on board, and if we crash those planes into your buildings and you got double indemnity and, you know, more money out of them than they're worth, and we could use that as an excuse or provocation to start a war, hey, this would take care of everything.
Over the next few months, we are going to bring to the public the ugly face of what really happened on 9/11 and who is behind it.
Some senators have described this as a second Pearl Harbor.
There have been many excellent documentaries on 9/11. Many of these documentaries have uncovered much of the hidden secrets behind the story.
That have been planned for at least a year.
On our series, we're going to attempt to put a face on all of this. The people. Why they did it. Who did
it? We are not exactly sure at the moment of the whereabouts of the Secretary of Defense.
We will attempt to bring you the facts, plain and simple. Our 9/11 series will name the names. We'll tell you who did it. And we'll present the evidence to back up that story. 9/11, now on the Jerry Pippen Show. We have many episodes already, so just go over to jerrypippen.com and click on the Confiles. You'll see the little button at the top. Let's get to the UFOs. And what a UFO show we have today with Art Campbell. And this is something you'll want to hear. Art stopped by when we made an appointment with him to meet him in Eureka Springs at the UFO conference a couple of years back. And we basically sat in a little room and recorded one heck of a show. So let's go ahead and play that now. President Eisenhower flying into Holloman Air Force Base right outside Albuquerque, New Mexico, to meet ETs at the end of the runway. Listen to the show and make up your own mind. Welcome to a very unusual show. I say unusual simply because we have some living witnesses to what our guest is going to testify to. I don't know if it's really a testifying or just an interview as such, but we've done many of these shows in which researchers come on and they talk about certain incidents in the past, but all of the witnesses are either dead or missing or something. This is not the case this time around. Our subject is President Eisenhower, meeting with ETs. Now, most of us have heard about the Edwards Air Force Base affair in 1954, but our guest, Art Campbell, a UFO researcher, has found some evidence that holds up, in my opinion, about a possible Eisenhower ET meeting at the end of a runway, not at Edwards, but at Holloman Air Force Base, right outside Albuquerque in New Mexico, in February of 1955. Stay tuned. We're going to present some of the living witnesses and their testimony. But before we do that, let's talk to Art Campbell. Welcome to the show, Art. And I think it's best probably to maybe explain to the audience a little bit about your backgrounds.
Well, I've been a UFO researcher actively since 1989. All before that, I was very active with NICAP and 30 years of teaching involved. So I was...
Teaching, a
high school teacher. Uh-huh, a high school teacher.
High school, okay.
High school. I taught high school. I was a school administrator. I was an art teacher.
Was it up in Oregon where you live now?
No, actually, I was teaching in started teaching in Kansas City, Kansas.
Okay.
There, I graduated from the Art Institute there in Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri. Started teaching Kansas City, Kansas, and then we moved west to Colorado in the 60s. And I pretty well hung up the UFO stuff for about 25 or 30 years because there's very little interest in UFOs in small towns. And we moved back to southern Oregon in the town of Medford, where I got reinterested in UFOs.
I'm quite familiar with
that. The background of Eisenhower going on his vacation trip to...
Now, this is not the first time Eisenhower has told the press he's going to do something. He did something differently. Remember the dental story in Edwards Air Force Base?
This was a year afterward.
No, I know.
Apparently, he learned from that experience and decided when he went down, he went to visit the aliens again, if that's what was his agenda, that he was not going to have the press hanging all over his neck. And so he slipped them this time on totally. Now, they didn't know he was coming to Holloman, but people back there thought he was laid up with a cold in a plantation house owned by Secretary of the Treasury Humphrey.
And that was in Georgia.
That was in Thomasville, Georgia.
So, the press was far, far away.
They were far, far away, 5 hours and 1,300 miles, we figure.
Have you been able to figure out what was going on, who he was meeting with exactly? I mean, is this the same group probably that he met at Edwards, or do you have any idea?
I don't know about – I don't have information about Edwards. But
yeah.
I can talk to the fact that he was said he went there. I don't doubt that there was alien material there. I don't know whether he would talk to them or not, or if things have been set up. You know, it takes a while to get interpreters and things like that ready to go to do any real business. I'm sure that there were some alien bodies there. We know that there was lots of UFOs seen at Edwards, and it's quite possible that he did see and talk to someone there.
But you have the evidence on Holloman here firsthand.
Right.
And Holloman seems to have been, in fact, New Mexico really seems to be the center of a lot of UFO activity and ET contact.
Well, of course.
Haven't you found that out in your research?
Yes, it does seem to be the center of the universe as far as extraterrestrial craft goes that means we're going to have more crashes here and more things, more events happening. And as far as we know, Holloman was, as far as we suspect, Holloman was kind of a clearinghouse for alien landings because it was so secure. They could come and go there without being shot at or looked upon. And the base at Holloman was extremely tight. And getting anybody from Holloman even today to talk is difficult. So they were a very close fraternity there at Holloman.
Have you spent any time in Holloman personally to try to find out?
No, I haven't. I did get a letter from the Air Force that said that Eisenhower's plane was sitting at Spence Air Force Base in Georgia for 5 days. And then,
they denied that it was ever in Holloman.
Right, yes, they denied it was ever there.
But you have evidence otherwise.
Well, I have eyewitnesses that saw his plane land,
right. Uh-huh.
And he was expected at Holloman because they were going to do a parade for him with his standard attention, knowing guys are getting off the plane. And that was canceled by ahead of time, that there wasn't going to be a parade. But we did have people see him arrive, and had one guy, this airman, Kirtland, saw him take off. And we have secondhand witnesses then as to what transpired while he was.
This man that we've interviewed, has he come forward? What are we calling him? Are we calling him his real name, or we have a?
It's similar to his real name,
okay.
But yeah, we're calling him Wilbur Kirkland.
Okay.
And at his request, but it's easier to talk.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Has he had any repercussions since this has come out?
No, he hasn't. He's a very cautious man, and he's had no repercussions because we're not using his real name. Now, I haven't been visited by the men in black yet either, although I am a little, every time I see a Mormon missionary come up the sidewalk, I wonder what's in that briefcase.
Yeah, this is a dark blue jacket, not black. So.
Okay.
you're calling this the Eisenhower Project?
That's one of the names for it. His plane took quite a journey from Thomasville. In 1955, in July 9th to be exact, Eisenhower mentioned at a press conference that he had something of little interest to anybody in the room, but he and his family, that he was going hunting in Georgia for a few days. And he'd been went down to Secretary Humphrey, by the way, who was a Treasury Secretary in those days, who owned a plantation down near Thomasville, mm-hmm. Georgia. And he'd been there the year before, and they had wonderful, apparently wonderful hunting. And they got all the limit of the birds and what have you and so forth. And so he was going back this year. Well, it's a strange time to go, Jerry, because the Red Chinese had started shelling Formosa.
Yes.
Today we know it as Taiwan, of course. And Eisenhower had promised to defend Formosa before he was elected in 52. And he told the international press that if they made any serious overtures toward invading Formosa, that we would use nuclear weapons. He didn't say bombs, but we were developing nuclear artillery shells and other things in those days that would be pretty formidable to come up against. And the whole world got upset at this statement that we were going to use nuclear weapons on Red Chinese if they invaded Formosa. Well, where was Russia in all this? Russia had just lost their first premier, Malenkov, after Stalin's death. Malenkov had been appointed by Stalin to succeed him. And he hadn't worked out his five-year plan and what have you, and this was 1955, 2 years after Stalin's death. So the Russians were all on edge about a new leadership. And it's a funny time to go bird hunting, I'll tell you that, when the whole international situation is kind of on tether hooks. So some of the press decided to go bird hunting with Eisenhower. And they chartered a plane. There were 30 different people on that press plane. We had Time Magazine, Warner Path News, Life Magazine, New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, all the well-known papers of the day. And they were on this airplane, and they were going to stay with Ike to make sure if World War III broke out, they'd be nearby to get some news. They put them up at a place in Thomasville called the Scott Hotel. And it was kind of a news center, and every morning Presidential Secretary Hagerty would come in, give him a little briefing, and so forth and so on. And so when Ike got there on the evening of the 10th, he went out bird hunting with just a few of his guys with him,
uh-huh.
and got a couple of birds. But it was starting to be drizzly cold. And that night it went down to something like 20 above. Everything, the drizzle froze it to ice. And, of course, anybody in the audience that's ever done bird hunting knows if you're using dogs, they can't smell anything when it's iced over very well. So they said Ike went out the next morning and didn't do too well and had gone to the cottage, had the sniffles, and he and his valet were treating the sniffles. And he was drinking hot toddies and with Mamie by the fireside playing Scrabble. And the press thought that, well, we have a president that's ill. They're going to keep him indoors for a few days. And so they had taken with them 13 Secret Service agents on that trip. Normally they only take five. And one of the Air Force guys we contacted, Air Force One crewman, said that was the only time they ever remember that many Secret Service men. They didn't even have enough room for them in Eisenhower's plane. Some of them had to go on the press plane. And I said, why was that? He said, well, sometime back in the mid-50s, we assume this is the occasion.
Yeah.
They had taken Ike, went west, stuck out west from a hunting trip. They left the other five or six people there to pretend Ike was there. So he needed double Secret Service to pull off the ruse. And he got apparently to Holloman about 8:45 on the morning of the 11th of February 1955. His plane taxied and down on the end of the runway and shut down. And we have an airman, Airman Kirtland, who's going to give us some information about what transpired.
Art Campbell is our guest. And our subject is Dwight David Eisenhower, President of the United States in 1955. Did he meet ETs at the end of the runway at Holloman Air Force Base? Art, you have some witness testimony. I think we're ready to hear it.
Okay.
Here in a
now, our first segment will be when his friend Dorsey comes to the hospital where the airman's working. He's a high altitude flight chamber specialist, and his supervisor had been out to the commissary with his wife and had seen a UFO hovering over the flight line at Holloman. And here is that information from Airman Kirtland.
So when I went to normal work the next morning, at about 8 o'clock, I walked into the flight surgeon's office and I was asked by the nurse if I had seen Dorsey. And Dorothea Thorenson, who worked there, said, I saw him. She says, and he was going to the commissary with his wife. So I didn't think anything more of it, and I just went on. Dorothea was a clerk typist in the flight surgeon's
office.
Yes, a civilian. She was married, and she had a very nice car. I remember it was Oldsmobile Holiday. when she said that he had come in later, I didn't think anything of it. When I went to coffee that day, but before I went to coffee, I saw Dorsey coming down the hall. He was an airman who was in charge of the men, the other airmen, at the flight surgeon's office. And he said, Bill, have you seen what's out there on the flight line? And I'm thinking, no, I haven't seen anything. He says, you should go and see it. I says, what is it? He said, it's a disc. When he said disc, I'm thinking a disc like we threw at college, about this big, with a silver or stainless steel rim, wood. And
the track discus that they use the track team.
Oh, yeah, that was a track discus. Yeah. That's what I expected. He says, no. I says, what's it made out of? He said, metal. And I said, oh, what's its color? He says, silvery, stainless polished steel, stainless steel or silver. And I said, well, how big is it? I'm still thinking 12 inches or less. He said, 20 to 30 feet. I said, what's it doing? He says, hovering in the air. The only craft that I knew could hover was the hovercraft that the Navy was talking about building, flying pancake or flying flapjack, the hovercraft that would come in on off the shore, and a helicopter. And this wasn't any of those. So I said, well, I'll go and see it. He says, it's out in front. Just go to the front of the hospital and take a look. So to do that, I had to ask permission. And I went up to where an officer was being examined and knocked on the door, and the nurse came to it and said, I said, can I go to the front of the hospital and look down flight way? And she looked at the doctor, and she said, no. So I didn't
Okay.
Go.
Well, you ask a little bit about Kirtland's background, and he has a very impressive background. He's a high school graduate from Montebello, California, and joined the Air Force in 1952 and went to his basic training at Parks, which a lot of them did in those days. And he specialized in his training in high-altitude medicine and at Gunther Air Force Base in Alabama, where he did his training. And while he, after the Air Force, we can get into that a little bit later, but he did go to college and was quite had quite a name for himself. He went to Long Beach State College in applied math and minor physics. So we're talking about a pretty bright guy here.
Mm-hmm.
Later, he worked for North American Aviation in Burbank, Collins Radio in Newport Beach, Motorola Radio, and Lockheed Missile and Space in Houston. And he worked for NASA doing the trainers for the Apollo program. And he spent 24 years.
So he has quite a background.
Yes, 24 years in computers, plus his 9 years, four years in the military, sorry, 4 years in the military, gave him almost 30 years of government service. So he has quite a credible background.
Okay.
And he went to coffee that morning. You want to hear this one?
Yeah. Well,
this is a great one, too. He went to coffee that morning and was walking behind a couple of officers who were talking about Eisenhower having landed that morning. And One of the guys that was ahead of him was the officer of the day, and most of us have been in the military. Remember, the officer of the day is the guy that checks, walks around, makes sure everybody's doing their job, right?
Right, right.
And he was in a blue uniform while everybody else on the base was in khakis. So that's how you can tell the OD's coming, if he's got a different uniform on usually. Now, I was always looking for a chief petty officer in a black uniform when I was in the Navy.
You in the Navy.
Right, yeah, say, yeah. Right. Well, we had them, too. They came around, too.
Yeah.
But anyhow.
I was in the Army. We had them.
Yeah, yeah. And so they talked about this officer of the day had been in the tower at Holloman when Eisenhower's plane landed, and talks about Ike and the UFO coming down in front of Eisenhower's plane. Let's listen to this. It will be really good.
Okay.
When I went on coffee break about 9 o'clock, 9:30, I came back from coffee and I was following two pilots. The one on the right was wearing blues and the one on the left was wearing khakis. Now, at Holloman during winter, normal work procedures, unless you were assigned official duties, was khakis. If you were assigned a job like officer of the day or something like that, or meeting somebody formally, you would wear blues. The man on the right was wearing blues. He was a second lieutenant. The one on the left was wearing khakis. Now, the one on the left was wearing khakis, and I heard them talking back and forth, and one of them said, "Did you see Air Force One?" I didn't know what Air Force One was. I had to ask later what it was, what it meant. And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Big Bird, isn't it?" He says, "Yes." And when he was talking about that, he said, "Well, what happened?" And the one on the right said, "I'm the officer of the day." He said, "What happened is they landed on the runway." He says, "And turned around and stayed on the active."
What does the word active mean?
Well, it means that's the runway that they're using to land and take off airplanes from.
And no other planes are allowed on.
No, not there, not at that time. So, he turned around on the active. He said, "We were told to turn off our radar." Well, after we shut off the radar, he says, they came over the mountains, over the White Sands Proving Ground and the monument. He says, "I heard," and the one on the left said, "I heard one landed at the monument."
Can you explain the monument?
The monument is White Sands Monument, and it's down the road from Holloman Air Force Base to the west.
It's an area, area?
It's a public park monument. And right. What he was saying was he had heard that one of them landed there. And the one on the right said, "I don't know whether that was true or not." He says, "I'm telling you what I saw. What I saw is one came overhead, two of them came over. One landed on the runway in front of them." He says, "And the other one hovered overhead 200, 300 feet. He said, "And what happened?" He said, "Well, he got out of the airplane and walked down, and he couldn't see the door opening on this craft because he didn't have binoculars." And then he said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "He went aboard the craft for 40 or 45 minutes. And
now, who was he?
The person who got out of Air Force One. It was his plane. So it had to be Eisenhower. Now, I didn't see this, but it just had to be Eisenhower. And Eisenhower is a very brave man, and he would have no problems going aboard a foreign UFO, if that's what it was, for 40 or 45 minutes.
I have a question here, Bill. Was there a gangway or something out that area?
So they probably had a ladder structure of some type.
At least as high as a basketball goal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So he came down and went aboard, walked to the craft and went aboard. He said, "Well, then what happened?" He says, "Well, when he got out, shook hands, and he walked off. And he went out of the airplane and walked back to his... He went out of their craft and walked back to his own airplane."
Well, there was one other time I asked him, I said, "Well, where did you see Eisenhower?" He said, "I didn't see Eisenhower." He said, "I saw his plane. But I... had a chance to go see a UFO, and then my doctor turned me down. Apparently the word was out that when the president gets here, it's business as usual, no gawking or anything like that. We want everybody to do business as usual. He's not coming to inspect the facilities. He's just coming for a visit. That was what the people were told a couple weeks before I came. So Airman Kirtland did his that duty that day and went back to his barracks and never got a chance to see Eisenhower. And finally somebody said, hey, Ike's plane's warming up. It's going to be taking off any minute. He's coming down the runway now. So all the guys in the barracks went running out to look at Eisenhower's plane. And Kirtland said he got out there just in time to see it fly over and turn off and towards the base housing. Now, no one flew over base housing. And he said the only guy who could get away with it was the president. Mm-hmm. Because, any accidents would be quite dreadful. So here's Airman Kirtland talking about that incident. It only goes about 30 seconds, but quite good.
I went to work, and after work, I was called out of my room in the barracks and ran out in the back, and Air Force One was flying overhead. Anyway, it flew over the residential area, and no airplane was allowed to turn and fly over the residential area of the Air Force base there because it wasn't safe. If they crashed, it would crash into these residents. Yeah. So the only one that got away with it was Air Force.
Well, later on, Airman Kirtland's job, as far as we were able to determine, was that he wanted to make sure that the office, the medical office, was secured. And he saw some lights on over at the medical office, one of the offices, and from his barracks window, and decided to go over there and see what was going on. Well, he went in there and found his good friend, the Dr. Reiner, and a friend of his, a lieutenant colonel, who was also an officer of the day, wearing the blue uniform. And they're talking about Eisenhower speaking on the base that day. And apparently there were several talks at least 400 people. So we thought it would be hard to find witnesses for this event, and it was difficult. But we also talking about civilians who weren't under any great secrecy. The military guys still are pretty mum about it. And we found two well-known military people, a Dr. Simons, who did the high-altitude balloon ascent.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the people there at the base. And when we asked him about it, a friend of his asked him about it. He would not answer the question. That's strange. And the man's 98 years old now, and he still won't answer the question about something that happened 55 years ago.
Wow.
Then there was another one called, he was a very famous guy, Kittinger. Kittinger did the 102,000-foot parachute free fall drop in 1960, which is still a record, almost died doing it. We got a hold of Kittinger in Florida and said, do you remember, we never mentioned anything about aliens or UFO craft. Uh-huh. Do you remember Eisenhower visiting the base? And we had information ahead of time that Kittinger had lunch with Eisenhower. Well, Kittinger had a poor memory, so we'll put it truthfully. He said, I don't recall Eisenhower being there. It must have been after I left. So some of your top brass were still want to perpetuate that myth that nothing happened. And we've heard that one before, haven't we?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to hear the conversation now between Airman Kirtland and his boss, Dr. Reiner, over at the AeroMed lab after hours.
That night after supper, I looked at the flight surgeon's office, and one of my jobs is to check and make sure that the lights and everything was secure. I saw lights over there. So I went in the back way, and when I went into the back way, I was talking. I saw Captain Reiner talking to a lieutenant colonel who was dressed in blue. Reiner had his white coat-like, smock-like on. They were talking. And the one, and the colonel said, I don't know about others. He said, well, I'm telling you what I saw. He said, I was standing on the stage with him. And Reiner spoke up and said, I heard that he spoke also at the base theater. He said he might have. He only spoke a couple of minutes at the one place. And then the base commander took over, and he spoke for about 20 minutes. So it was plenty of time for him to go from the supply hangar to the base, to the base theater and back again. He said, I'm telling you what I saw. Standing room only in the supply hangar, 225 men each time. He said, there might have been a third time. He said, but I wasn't there. And I said, who spoke? And the lieutenant colonel said, commander-in-chief. And I said, the president. And he said, the commander-in-chief. He repeated himself. Well, I know, and you know, that the commander-in-chief is the president.
Okay, you were asking earlier about other witnesses besides this one man.
Uh-huh.
We were able to find two.
Two witnesses. Art, let's take a break. Another half hour to go, folks. A riveting story about Eisenhower and his meeting on the runway at Holloman Air Force Base in Albuquerque, February 1955. We'll be back in a moment. Investigator and author Anthony Sanchez.
The name of the book is UFO Highway. I found that although I was diverging into multiple areas of UFO research, I kept finding myself back on the same road. And I found that all these different aspects of ufology were interconnected. So I decided to call the book UFO Highway.
This is the book that could not wait for a regular publisher. It had to be released now. The information is so sensitive, so shocking, so well researched. Colonel X comes from the dark shadows for the light of truth. The inside story of Area 51 and the challenging truth about extraterrestrials. The e-book of the century, now on sale. For information and to order, go to UFOHighway.com. This is Jerry Pippin. We're talking with Art Campbell, and we're talking about Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, visiting an ET at the end of the runway at Holloman Air Force Base back in 1955. Art, how about other witnesses?
We're able to find two. As a result of an article in UFO Magazine, I was contacted by a lady who lives in southeastern Nebraska. And she said her father was an electrician at Holloman and told a story about seeing what was a UFO at a later time. And he was there apparently in 1955, and they had just moved down there from Albuquerque. She was in the fourth grade, about 9 or 10 years old, and recalls Dad coming home saying that he'd had this experience. But at the time, the people there did not realize what UFOs were. Even at the top secret bases, the extraterrestrial thing was absolutely not even considered among the average, mm-hmm. average person. And so what he thought he saw was a German secret weapon that the paperclip guys who were working at Alamogordo in those days in the White Sands Missile Range had developed, and he thought maybe Eisenhower had come to see this secret innovation. Well, anyhow, his daughter here is going to be reading a letter that she found in her archives, and it's a family letter that's a classic. And they always had Dad tell this story whenever they had family reunions about the time Dad became a fireman. And the reason he became a fireman was when he saw that UFO, he got down that pole real fast. So we're going to hear this lady from, she lives in the area of Auburn, Nebraska, talking about her father, the electrician, and the day he became a fireman.
Letter's right here. I'm sure I'll find that one. Yeah, here's the one that Mom and Dad wrote. Okay, that's Auburn, Nebraska, October 26, 1989. Dear kids, it's beautiful fall here with the usual pumpkins up and down the main drag. Kids are getting excited. Your father and I are doing well. Heard from Helen. She said the grandchild came on time, and although Sharon was in labor, well, you don't need to talk about that. Anyway, Dad has just come from the kitchen with a cup of coffee, and he says he doesn't mind telling the fireman's story again, but you kids know it better after all these years. But he'll recall what he can. All right, this is the part. Well, you kids and Mom moved down from Albuquerque, I think it was in the summer of 1954. As you recall, I had taken the Hollerman job that previous winter, and Mom wanted us all together, so we rented a place over near Dudley Elementary School on Maryland, wasn't it? Remember, you kids could walk to school. You were in the fourth grade, and Billy was in first or second. Anyhow, sometime after Christmas of 55, we were told President Eisenhower was coming. So George, our boss then at the electric shop, went to a meeting to find out more. He would not be inspecting anything, and they said just carry on as usual. If you see the president, don't gawk, wave, or anything, just carry on. So the day the president came, we went out in the truck to a job where we were replacing some wire down the flight line. It was really old stuff, but that put there in World War II, and safe. So we heard the president's plane in the morning lining up for an approach and watched it land on the far runway. So we waited for it to taxi over to the flight line so we could see him. But we didn't hear it anymore, and it had shut down somewhere out there. So we went ahead and pulled wire for a while, and one of the men, I believe it was Charlie, said he can see out there from that pole over there. So why don't one of us go up the pole and see where the plane is? Well, I had my climbers on, and I started to unbuckle them and was waiting to give them to the first volunteer. When someone said I should do it, as people were used to seeing me up on the poles anyway. So I started up with my back to the sun, a safety measure, which also put my back to the runway where we thought his Connie was. Connie was a nickname for the big constellation the president flew. As I started up, some of the guys reminded me not to gawk, and I heard them laugh. A few minutes later, I heard some shouting, and some guys tarring a hangar roof nearby started to run, pointing out to the runways. Then I heard our truck start up, and some of the crew jumped in with one or two running after it. And they were pointing out to the flight line, and so I decided to turn around on the pole to see what the ruckus was about, and I could not believe what I saw. There was this pie tin-like thing coming at me about 150 feet away. I thought it was remote controlled or something. 25 to 30 feet across, and I started down the pole as fast as I could go. I was up about 40 feet, and I threw my climbing rope out, gave it slack, and only touched the spike on each side of the pole three or four times on each side in before I got to the bottom. While I was running towards the big hangar, I looked back and it had stopped and was just sitting there. Well, when we all got back to the shop and we had a good lap, one of the guys who saw me come down said he got down that pole faster than a fireman. So as you kids were growing up and we had the family gatherings, you used to ask to tell me about the time I became a fireman. You know, I always wondered why we did not use that thing during Vietnam and so forth. And over the years, I realized if we had technology like that, it would have saved lots of lives. But I gradually realized that it had something to do with Ike being there that day. And it wasn't ours. It was an unwritten rule at Holloman. You didn't talk about what you saw. And after that day, it was seldom mentioned at the shop. I still have those climbers here someplace. Billy used to play with them. Remember? Mom here again. Well, Dad's wandered outside someplace. He said something about checking the pump. It's been sluggish lately. Dad thinks the motor's old and needs rewinding. He spends several hours a week up at Harold's helping out with mechanical and electrical stuff for farm equipment. Dr. Fornash says it's okay for Dad to drive a little around town, but to keep an eye on him. He thinks Dad has had a mini stroke or two, but should not do any highway driving at night. He drags his left foot a little, but gets out to the golf course in good weather. But he has to use a cart now. We're looking forward to seeing all of you at Christmas. Say hi to Bob and Warren for us and hug the twins. All of our love.
We had a
Mom and Dad.
Quite a few, a lot of interest in this. And as a result of a radio program we did back in in Southern Oregon, I got a call from a man. He said, well, I have a brother that lives down in Oakland. And he was in the B-29 pilot, not a pilot, but a gunner. And he said, when he comes up, would you like to talk to him? He told me he saw the president once at an Air Force base. I certainly would like to talk to him. So the guy we're talking to here is, it's not his real name, but it's close. And he's talking about his experience. Well, let me give you his background. Staff Sergeant Wyckoff had been a 17-year-old enlistee in the Air Force during World War II. He was trained as a tail gunner in the B-29s. He saw 43 missions over Japan. Was in on the low-level raids when they dropped incendiary bombs over Tokyo and practically burned the whole city down in one night. And was in on the battle of Okinawa. He can tell you when and where they went to do the bombing and where he was when the atomic bomb went off and so forth. He's quite a credible man. He's seen an awful lot of combat. I like to use combat veterans because generally they're pretty unassuming. And they really haven't got, they don't tell stories usually.
Mm-hmm.
The real ones don't. So, anyhow, to set the base up here, the thing up here, Sergeant Wyckoff was running freight out of Vacaville Air Force Base in Indiana. And he was to deliver some material to Holloman Air Force Base. On the 10th, the 10th of February, 1955. Later on, we'll tell you how we happen to know the date. And they arrived, got their freight unloaded, and they were due to leave the next morning, which is what they usually do. You spend the night at the enlisted barracks, and the officers go to the officers' club. And they were told to report down to the flight area, and their plane will be ready at about 9 o'clock the next morning. So they got down there about 8:30, checked things over, and the officer down there at the flight area said that the flight had been canceled and that we sent your lieutenant back to the officer's quarters and that they want you to, we can't let the flight take off because we just closed the airport, closed the runway. This is a very long runway at Holloman and they closed it. And so he said, well, why? He said, well, President Eisenhower is coming in a few minutes and we don't want any planes taking off or revving up the motors or what have you, as long as the president is here. Well, how long will he be here, the staff sergeant? Well, we're not sure, but we're going to close this runway, and you guys might as well go on back to barracks. You stay here if you want to. His plane's coming in now. So he sees Air Force One land at Holloman Air Force Base and taxi down and stop at the far end of a runway. And we found out earlier why he had stopped, because they wanted to be as far away from the people as possible. So when the UFOs came in, they would not be around a lot of people. And so they put them at the far end of the runway. Well, probably Eisenhower had this whole trip set up to come to Holloman to meet the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to make sure it was in a secure place. It was in a secure base, that's for sure. And out on the end of the runway, not many people could see what was going on out there, except unless you had binoculars. Then I understand the door of the UFO was facing the sagebrush. You couldn't see a whole lot there. But, yeah, we heard earlier where some of the officers had said I was walking down the between Air Force One and the UFO. I found this all hard to believe myself until I started talking to all these people, and they start to fall together. In any case, here's Sergeant Wyckoff and what he observed and what he heard on that day, February 11th, 1955.
While I was out in Indiana, my job was loading and delivering a cargo. We went to Washington, where they opened a new base with cargo, and just kind of anything they wanted, we would fly it.
What other bases did you go to?
Well, I went to March and Holman two or three times. We hauled what we think is stuff for the atomic bomb.
Dave, what do you recall about Holman?
Well, we had a haul a load of stuff down there, parts that they needed, and the runway is like this, and I never seen anything like that before. And anyway, as we were there, we saw Air Force One come in, and we didn't know who it was. And then we come, an officer come around and says, "You can't leave." And I says, "Well, the pilot said we have to leave." And he says, "Well, President Eisenhower's here, and you can't leave the field until he's gone." And I says, "You can hear him over loudspeakers, but it didn't do any good, you know. I would have liked to have seen him." And this officer, we didn't have the clearance to go into the mess hall. And one of the other officers, a higher-ranking officer, came to us and says, "Would you like to go in and eat and listen to a speech?" And most of us said, "Yeah, because I'd like to see him." I didn't get to shake his hand or anything, but because I didn't have the right badge, clearance, to go in. But they did leave us go in at the very end, and we ate and listened to his speech.
What did you think of him?
I thought he was great. He had a lot of good ideas. Maybe he had some I disagreed with, but I don't agree with everybody anyway, you know.
Dave, do you remember what date that was that you were there?
The reason I know it, when he was there is here's what I got discharged. He was there in mid-February in 1955. That was my last trip that I made while I was in the service. Then I was discharged, and I came back home to the Bay Area with my family.
In interviewing Sergeant Wyckoff in Oakland, I went down twice. It's about an eight-hour drive from my home in Southern Oakland, Oregon.
Portland.
Yeah.
No,
Oakland, California, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's from the Bay Area.
Okay.
Originally. So we had to check and make sure somebody's just not pulling our leg, you know. And I said, "How did you know that it was the 9th or 10th of February, 1955? He said, "That was my last trip." And he pulls out his discharge. And it says, "Honorably discharged, February 22nd, 1955. He told me he was discharged about 10 days later. Mm-hmm. He pulls out his discharge. And we've made a video of this, by the way. And there it is, February 22nd, mm-hmm. 1955. So here's a man that was not under any great secrecy because he was from another air base. But they wouldn't let him in to see Ike initially because he didn't have the right badge on. But he did get to hear him and one of the other talks.
Art, we have to take a break, but when I come back, you've got to tell our audience about what this man, Arthur Godfrey, has to do with President Eisenhower in the flight to Holloman Air Force Base.
Let's have another cup of Lipton tea.
Lipton tea and Lipton soup present Arthur Godfrey and his talent scout.
It's
Thank you. Thank you, George Bryan, Peggy Marshall in the Holidays, Archie Blyer in the orchestra, and a special welcome to you folk who are kind enough to come to the studio tonight.
Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know. And I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for him with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much, and no other personalized tour offers a better price.
No, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon now. $85 a person. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at MarvelousMarv.com.
This is London. Tonight, London is a city of song and celebration and thanksgiving. There are fireworks and parties. Air raid shelters are as remote as the covered wagon. Many words have been spoken and much drink has been consumed. London has been somewhat hysterical and still is. The organized killing has ended in Europe. The young men of many nations have suffered, sacrificed, and achieved victory. The coming months and years will reveal what will be done with that victory.
Edwin R. Murrow and Arthur Godfrey, President Dwight David Eisenhower, ETs on a runway at Holloman Air Force Base. They're all connected somehow, right, Art?
Jerry, you asked about the passenger list. We were able to get the passenger list of this airplane from Flight 58 from the Eisenhower Library at Abilene, Kansas. And it is extraordinary. Of course, there's Secretary Humphrey on there with Ike's hunting party, Mrs. Dowd, Amy's mother, one or two other people, a Garden Carter, some other people that hunted with Ike usually. About six or seven people were in the hunting party. Well, going on down the list, number 17 was Arthur Godfrey.
Well,
what's he going to do, a soft shoe in the aisle with a ukulele, you know?
Put him on talent scouts.
Right, put him on, let him entertain them while they're going on their one-hour flight down to Georgia. And that, Arthur Godfrey, is this the real one, you know? Well, it turned out it was the real one. And we were able to find out from a website called ConnellRad. I recommend it to you, some of your listeners. They deal solely with information that went on during the nuclear scare in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So great website. And apparently CBS had two well-known people, Edward R. Murrow and Arthur Godfrey, that were retained by the government to make commercials and not a commercial aspect, but to make it a public service announcement in case we were attacked by nuclear war and said everything is okay, folks. So here's grandfatherly voice, Arthur Godfrey, and many of your listeners will remember how what a golden voice he had.
Right.
Remember the day. And then there's Edward R. Murrow.
Right.
We all know, our generation knew Edward R. Murrow, mm-hmm. and they know it for many generations to come. He was the famous CBS broadcaster from This Is London.
Yes.
World War II.
You're
remember?
Right.
Yes. Well, they had taken both of these voices and put them on tape. By the way, the tapes have not been found. But Frank Stanton, who was
the president
of CBS, yes, said in several interviews before he died in 2006 that they had recorded both Godfrey and Edward R. Murrow to make an announcement in case we had been attacked by nuclear bombs, that the government was alive and well, and they had built these huge facilities down at down in the south. It's maybe 25-30 minutes from Washington. One down at the Greenbrier Inn was one,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And we've seen them on TV in various places, and huge underground facilities. Now, while we were all groveling around in the dark and under our under house shelters. Here was our government doing well down there in some of these very opulent motels. And, of course, they had glass doors 6 feet thick, and it was absolutely incredible. Well, let's get back to why would we have Arthur Godfrey, who was not a social guest, on Eisenhower's personal plane? Your guess is as good as mine, but maybe they were afraid that war would break out, and they'd have a spokesman with them.
Yeah, they didn't have the Formosa thing going on at
that
time. Oh, why?
It was in those, for us at the time, it was as close to the nuclear war as we've ever seen. Now, of course, 1960 was a little closer with Kennedy. But this was close because the Russians and the Chinese were very upset. And
the press and CBS never told CBS News that Arthur Godfrey was on that plane.
Well, Arthur Godfrey made many trips on that plane. I found out from the Air Force One personnel. Yes. They even had a seat.
So it wasn't unusual.
No, a seat reserved for him back in the crew quarters. He liked the inside back corner of the window.
Yeah, he was a pilot.
He had been a pilot,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, at one time.
Yes, the pilot.
And he was quite interested in
the Coast Guard for years during the Navy, and was quite an interesting man. And now, of course, Murrow wasn't on the flight, but we were able later to find out that Murrow had been advised. But that website, Conrad, talks about these various things. There was an article in Time magazine, I believe August of 1992, that told all about what the government had planned in case of nuclear war, the facilities, where they were, what they did. And we had, I don't know, 15,000, 20,000 people that were going to go underground immediately if they didn't get blown away to various places to keep the government working. And this is something Eisenhower had decreed about 1954 or 55. We've got to have a place for our government people if we have nuclear war so we can still function as a country. And I could not believe Arthur Godfrey's name was on that list.
Yeah, now, that's amazing. Brings,
you know, this is much more important than UFO than Holloman, the country going up in a mushroom cloud. And
sure.
What we were going to do about it, you know, Washington, D.C. It's amazing, amazing story.
So when we talk about all of this, the question I have, Art, and maybe there's no answer to it yet, who are these ETs? Who were they? Are they still around?
Our best information that I've been able to glean from various sources indicate that these ETs that Eisenhower, by the way, Eisenhower was only aboard that craft for 40 or 45 minutes, so you're not going to do much with a new race of people in 40 or 45 minutes. So it made me think that there was some business going on that was transacted there. Were they saying, lay off of the red Chinese, don't use your nukes? Or were they saying, hello and have a cup of coffee? I doubt it. It sounds to me like 45 minutes is too short for a social occasion.
Yeah, just kind of a time for a message.
It's too long to be chewed out.
Yeah, ultimatum, sort of.
So I think there was some negotiations going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on an angle. Can I mention my website?
Sure. Yeah.
I have the 7-part series done for Fireless Files on this Eisenhower thing on my website, which is www.artc@conpoint. I'm giving my email here. Let's try it again. www.ufocrashbook.com.
And we have a link to that.
Right, we have a link to that. So they'll be able to read all about the Eisenhower thing and the books that we've written on the crash at San Augustine. But back to your question on the aliens. It's our belief that these aliens that met Eisenhower at Holloman, and I'm not sure what the ones did at Edwards the year before, if there was a meeting, there may very well have been, were behind the peace process that started at Geneva that July. That eventually led to peace between the Soviet Union and the United States. At least we had peace for the major powers had peace. And I think eventually the peace kind of wore the Russians down and they collapsed.
So I may be stretching a little bit, but the hypothesis here is the aliens showed up, and they may have done the same thing and with the behind the Iron Curtain as well, and they
were looking in to see if there was any alien
intervention.
Contact.
Right, intervention for peace.
Intervention for peace. Now that's good news that we somebody is thinking that well of us and wants us to wishes us that well and is willing to get involved in it. I think that that meeting Eisenhower had on the tarmac on the runway there at Holloman. It very well could have been to encourage him to go and support that peace process or report to how other people were doing about it.
Maybe we can find out what was happening in the Soviet Union at the same time. That's going to be a little tougher, but...
Well, I've been talking to George Knapp, and he said that since Premier Putin got in, that the UFO things were pretty well closed down there. They were open for a while.
Yes.
So we're working other angles. There were some, the nationalist Chinese were there, as well as the red Chinese. We had Russia, France, and all the powers that had divided Berlin were there. We had Russia, France, United States, and Britain there, about 10 of the major world powers. We hope maybe we can find a window somewhere and see if we can work on this hypothesis that this may have been the beginning of a peace process.
That was from a broadcast we did with Art Campbell. And pretty remarkable, huh? This is Jerry Pippin, and this is our UFO show. Last week, on most of these stations, we basically had an abduction show. And we plan to have one every 4 or 5 weeks from now on. Through the rest of this year, UFO, ET abductions, a controversial subject. Is it emotional? Are these people for real? We've done many, many stories and many, many shows about it. And I just don't think everybody can be that creative, you know, in making up things. But, of course, there are people out there that say that it's all a figment of their imagination. You can listen to this lady. She dropped by our booth in Roswell, and we had been in contact with her, and she has quite a story. Listen to it and make up your own mind. Her story is not only about ETs, but also about government interference, black operations, maybe even causing deaths of abductees. Listen.
Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Welcome to the UFO Files. We're here in Roswell, New Mexico, and Gloria Hawker is with us. Gloria, I see you every year here.
For the last 4 years, since my book, Morning Glory, Diary of an Alien Abductee, was published.
Gloria, your book is a great read. I've heard lots of people talk and say good things about it. What time frame are we talking about with Morning Glory?
My awakening, meaning first conscious memory, occurred in September of 1988.
And do you live in New Mexico?
Yes, I do. I live in Albuquerque.
Yeah, I was there. So did it happen here in New Mexico?
Yes, it did. Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about the first thing that you remember, the first incident?
I would like to explain first that you're looking at a person here, Jerry, that was so naive in believing that our universe was just very small. I knew of our planets, you know, Saturn, Mars, etc.
Right.
And that we were basically the only human species, no other species.
Mm-hmm.
And above our small universe is heaven where God resides, you know, where we go.
Sure.
In September, after an accident, which...
You were talking about a car accident or something?
No, I was on my way to work at University Hospital. Mm-hmm. I used to work there.
Are you a
hospital.
Nurse? Or?
No, I was a clerical secretary.
Okay.
I used to work for several doctors.
Okay.
And there was a very hard push on my back, which threw me down about 10 stairs. There was no human that did this. And witnesses say that I literally flew towards this concrete wall. I injured both legs severely, had a slight concussion. The question was, who did it and why did I fly through the air in such a manner? That was answered a couple nights later.
While you were still in the hospital?
No, I was at home now. Mm-hmm. And not on any medication because I was having circulation problems.
Okay.
About 10:30 at night. I need to back up. I'm sorry.
Hey, that's easy enough, Gloria. Back up. We're backed up.
Hey, we,
go ahead and start again.
My children and I had just come home from visiting my folks around 10:30. I had gone upstairs to put away some clothing because I had just washed. And the outside balcony door was open, and this light, a very strong light, caught my eye. So I walked to the door and out to the balcony. And during this time, it's a balloon fiesta time.
Yes, which is famous in Albuquerque, right?
Yes,
uh-huh.
And at that point in time, they would allow hot air balloons to travel over the Sandia Mountains. But the question was, why is this balloonist out at 10:30 at night?
Mm-hmm.
Standing there several moments, minutes, this balloon doesn't move. And you don't hear the gas being ignited. It was there for very long time, and eventually I called my children, come up and look at the balloon.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange thing about it was we would look through the binoculars, and a very large light, circular in shape, would turn off, go out, and you would see in a circular pattern smaller little lights.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were playing games with us. Every time we would look at them through the binoculars, this big light would go off and the small lights would go on. They were playing games, mm-hmm. You know, repeatedly doing that. I called the TV station, radio stations, and of course they laughed at me.
Yeah.
Hear them really laughing at me. This object stayed there till after 3:30 the next morning. And before that, around 12:30, there was about six smaller circular lights across the Sandia Mountains, the crest of the Sandia Mountains,
mm-hmm.
Pulsating beautiful blues, peach, greens, orange colors.
Okay,
what were those? We don't know. Anyway, about 3:30 then, directly out of the canyon, directly towards my home, comes another bright white light in a circular pattern. Okay, then the 2 days later is when I had the accident.
And you think there's a connection, or you know there's a connection?
There was a connection, yes. And when I had the accident and I was bedridden, two nights later, lying in bed, and after family had left about 10:30 and 11, all the lights are out in the house,
mm-hmm.
and the house is securely locked. My north wall of the bedroom began fluctuating these beautiful colors, same colors of the small little circular lights that were on the crest of the Sandia Mountains there in Albuquerque. And couldn't understand it. Why am I hallucinating? And I hadn't realized at that point how my anxiety,
mm-hmm.
There was a sudden burst of anxiety. I didn't feel right. I just felt strange.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know why. I thought maybe because of the accident, how my legs were, etc.
Sure.
I was concentrating on all my injuries. What came through the wall, to me, they were ungodly creatures. There were five of them. Now, grays, of the small grays.
They just materialized through the wall.
Through the wall, through this fluctuating. The colors were like in panels, literally glowing in panels.
What happened?
Two of them came to the edge of the bed where my feet were.
Mm-hmm.
One by my stomach area.
Mm-hmm.
Another gray by my head area, who immediately began rubbing his three long fingers into my head. That's what I remembered. I couldn't do anything.
Right.
And I found out I couldn't even move my body because I tried to scoot away and get out of the bed, you know, dragging myself.
Sure, you're literally frozen.
I was literally frozen. They allowed me movement of my head. And what I call in my book, my head was going like 50 miles per hour.
Back and forth.
Because of the nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
The two at the end of the bed began unwrapping the thick bandage and padding they used on my legs to cover me. They couldn't cast me yet.
Okay.
So, excuse me, they began to unwrap my legs. The one on my side by my stomach, I could not tell what he was doing, but I remember him, you know, fingers, malignantly.
Could you feel the fingers?
Yes, and I couldn't tell what he was doing.
There was no pain?
Not at that time. I was scared stiff. And I was terrified because of the one that was by my head, going through my head. There was one gray by the door. And for some reason, I started hollering at him, "Don't you dare go down the hall and bother my..."
The maternal instinct.
Yes. And I threatened him, you know, "You do not do that." But he did. Now, through years later, when Mr. Bud Hopkins worked with me through hypnotherapy, we found out what they were doing to me. And that night, I had remembered a black satchel. It was kind of a weird box type thing. One of the grays had lifted this tube that was made out of like a skin, some type of hazy skin. And what it had in it, when I saw it, it was like peach and red to me.
Mm-hmm.
They took blood and within, you know, bone marrow, a lot of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what for. Anyway, why they unwrapped my legs was because so that they could get all of this. They were doing some type of work here on my stomach, on my ovaries and stuff.
Right.
And anyway, on that night as well, somehow, the gray, the one that was rubbing his hands through my hair, he did steal me and somehow implant it up here in my head. That's what came through hypnotherapy.
Okay, you found it through hypnotherapy. Okay.
Yes, many years later. After that one night, there are no words in our dictionary to explain what went on that night. I thought I was totally crazy, hallucinating, until my sister came over with Whitley Strieber's book, Communion, and showed me. She said, "Is this the gray or a picture of the being that came through the wall and did all this stuff to you?" And as soon as I saw that picture, it was like I died. And I said, "Yes." And we talked about it.
Now, your sister did this.
Yes.
And so she was aware of extraterrestrial.
Yes. She was more open-minded than I was, as well as my brother. And from that first night, I had a lot of paranormal happenings in the house, which was caused by these great species.
Now, did they make any noise at night?
No.
Just went about their business for a year. Did they rebandage your leg when they left?
It was not put on as tight and correctly. Uh-huh. It was put on kind of like sloppy.
You were probably very hesitant to tell almost anybody.
Yes. This, between 1988 and 1993, I led a very secret life. You don't go around talking about it to anybody. You can't.
Instances and over that 5-year period, do you think this happened to you? Countless
say maybe
times?
Yes, 50, over 50. And confirmation was, you know, seeing my daughter having shared visits with my daughter.
This is the one, the hybrid?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you don't know for sure if you had a hybrid? Okay, your real daughter?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell me about that, why the confirmation was there.
One, with one abduction, waking up on their table, I heard this young girl crying.
Mm-hmm.
And after getting my faculties together, because normally a bright light is set right above you while you're laying on the table, I would also get very, very cold every time. So they would bring this very smooth, like a rubberish type blanket that was warm and always cover me. And they would always allow me to have head movement.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you know, I'm looking around before they started working on me. And I looked towards the next table, and there's my daughter, my youngest daughter, lying there crying. And I do try to console her, and not knowing exactly where we were at the time, suspecting that, yes, could this be a possible spaceship or what, you know. And having been there before, I knew what was going to happen. And I wanted to be strong for her. I didn't want to cry. But inside, I was crying.
Sure.
And how can I get up? I tried to get up. But because, you know, they paralyze you, I could not move to get up to go to her. So all I could tell her is, it'll be over soon. It's okay. We're here together. And thus, they go ahead with their gynecological examinations or inserting, you know, the needles, taking blood, taking whatever they want under the control. And at times I would find at least six of these gray beings. Sometimes the beings would be a little bit taller. Sometimes they would have brown type skin, which you call the brown grays.
Okay.
I even found grays with skin colors such as mine.
Okay.
Which...
So you're calling them gray simply because they weren't gray, but they were shaped like grays.
Well,
but like
I would call them grays at the time. I didn't know what to call them. I
didn't
know
who. Right. I understand.
I would just call them.
So it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same group always.
Yes.
Oh, it was.
And then it became to where I was introduced to the insectoids, the praying mantis, your Nordics. In fact, in my book, I describe my Nordic as Paul Bunyan because of the way that they had him dressed that night when I first met him. And to me,
how was that?
They had us in a small room, like what you can find in a department store, in a dress store, the dressing rooms. And they had cubicles.
Okay.
And they had locked me into one cubicle. And I'm wondering, what's going on? And at this time, I had seen human beings on the ship. And
did the human beings act like they knew that you were there?
Yes, okay. Yes. And it was this human being lady, this female, that took me to this, like, a dressing room.
So she's literally doing whatever they wanted her to do.
Right, yes, like she was working with them. And she takes me and puts me in this cubicle and locks the little lock. So I'm standing there, what's going to happen to me? You know, I'm really fearful yet at this point in time. And because of all the other horrific testing that they had done to me, I was literally scared.
Well, sure.
You know, and I just...
Gloria, this probably still bothers you even to this day.
Well, I've adjusted now.
Okay.
I can accept, I can understand, because there's certain reasons for this. And anyway, okay, so I'm standing there waiting. What's going to happen to me now? And before I know it, looking through the little crack between the doors, they brought in this very huge man. And I had never seen a tall man like that before. I'm about 7 feet tall.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And he was very
muscular,
broad. Yes, yes. And so then she
was he built well?
Yes, just very big.
Like Andre the Giant.
Very handsome man, very handsome. And so after she put him into a cubicle but could not close the door. So
he was that big.
Yes.
The cubicle just wasn't made for his size.
Right. And she came and unlocked my door, and she says, follow me. So I start to follow him, her, and I stopped by his cubicle, and he was, you know, looking at me. I guess this is what was supposed to have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, I was looking at him, and honestly, I felt so small. He looked about 12 feet tall. I was so intimidated by his size.
I can understand that.
And right away, he knew my name. He said, Gloria, they're not going to hurt you with this next test. It's going to be okay. Don't be afraid.
So he spoke English and yes. talked to you in a regular voice. And
Yes, and why I call him Paul Bunyan is because they had him dressed in a dark blue, white, black checkered shirt. He did have, like, jeans on.
Mm-hmm.
He has long shoulder length, dark, very dark brown hair. He had a dark beard.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell that he had, he was very compassionate. Even though he had a deep voice, it was very soft to me, consoling to
yes,
me.
Yes,
And from that point in time, it seemed like he was always wherever I was when they would abduct me.
Interesting. Was he one of them? I guess he was.
He was what you call a Nordic.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
But, I mean, he was working in unison
yes.
with them?
Yes.
Wonder why they had him in the cubicle to begin with.
I have no idea. I really have
never
no
has,
idea.
I never said.
No, but that's where they set it up to meet him there.
Did this these experiences all of a sudden stop in 93?
Oh, no. No, they are still continuing.
He's still today.
Yes, today. I have met the reptilians, and the reptilians I thoroughly detest. Yes, they're very large. They have no respect at all for the human being.
Gloria, these reptilians, how did they communicate?
Telepathically as well.
Okay, okay. Yes. And that's the same with the praying mantis type. Did you talk to your daughter later about this?
Oh, verse. I mean, she had a lot of memory as well. And, yes, after every abduction, we would sit and we would talk this out. And during that time, too, we also met another mother and her daughter. And we shared experiences with this other mother and daughter.
Were they from Albuquerque, too?
Yes, we found each other, yes.
So this was all happening right in Albuquerque?
Yes, yes. Sometimes I would want to run away, you know, run
mm-hmm.
away and hide.
Oh, sure.
And we would go to another state.
But they would find you.
And they'd find me, yeah. They would always find us, yes.
How old were you, basically, in your 20s? Or?
No, about 45
okay.
years old at
that
time. Yes, yes.
And you'd never had an experience before that you knew about?
No, no. Through hypnotherapy, though, with Mr. Hopkins, there is definite reason to believe they were in my life as a child because of some stories that I mentioned in my book
mm-hmm.
and stories that I mentioned to him that we went through in hypnotherapy.
I'm a big fan of Bud Hopkins, and it seems to me that he must have helped you figure out a reason.
Oh, he is such a wonderful, loving, caring, very good investigator,
mm-hmm.
very good hypnotherapist in this field.
I mean, you said earlier that now you have a reason. You think you know why they were doing this to you.
It has.
Or am I putting words in your mouth?
No, there is a reason. And
is it in your book?
No, because recent research proves that this has been genetics. And why we were picked, you know, it's following.
It follows the family, tree.
Yes, ancestry.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was rather proven because my brother, he did do some research. And at the time when he did do family research, he was able to actually talk. with some great aunts and uncles yet before they passed. And being...
And Dad had experience.
Yes. Okay. And being Hispanic and Hispanic culture, Hispanics do not, anything like this would not talk. They kept it within.
They never discussed that at all.
No, because they don't want to be called insane. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be called crazy. Right. They don't want to be put into an insane asylum like many people many years ago.
You know, you didn't tell the doctor right off the bat, well, the ET's unwrapped my cast or my leg.
No,
I can understand why. But did you start telling people finally?
When my help came through Mr. Michael Linderman in 1993, he is the one that got a hold of Mr. Bud Hawkins.
Yes,
because there was just too many of these real dream experiences. And just sitting in the chair, my bedroom chair, where did these bruises come from? Where did these needle marks come from? Why am I feeling this way? There was just too much for me to handle. I couldn't understand until I had a daytime sighting, happening, abduction.
Mm-hmm.
And I told my family at that point in time, you're either going to get me some help by either taking me to a psychiatric ward, psychiatrist, or we need to find someone to help me with this problem. So Mr. Michael Lindemann happened to be in Albuquerque a couple of days later. And
he's a very interesting fellow, too.
Yes.
And so you're lucky you ran across some good people.
Yes, immediately. Mm-hmm. And I was able to talk to him that night.
Right.
And the following Tuesday, he had me calling in California, and that's when he connected me with Mr. Bud Hawkins. And from there, the learning that I have received, all the teaching, getting to meet other alien abductees, a whole realm of people in this field, in this phenomena field, were there for me. In 1997, because of what transpired on the ship with one of the taller grays, who I call the boss, I found a change because of what I had wanted to ask, a question.
Mm-hmm.
This question was about their supreme being. And because I had prayed to my God, my Lord, remove these ungodly creatures from my family, from my children, from me. Get them away. I don't want them in our lives anymore. And then something came over me and said, but, dear Lord, if they are of your creation also, then I will give of myself for human mankind. To ask a question to any of these species, you have to constantly, constantly repeat in your head the question. And that way, during an abduction, you'll be able to ask the question.
Did you get an answer?
Yes, I did. And what the answer was, that no theologian, no scientist, not even the Pope, no one knows of the greatest power, light of energy, can be experienced into death. We all have the same supreme being. All species of our universe, which is unending, have this and share this one supreme being.
And now you feel, even though it was a horrific experience, that maybe you were helping out this race or something, is that right?
Well, you feel like a lab rat up until that time, you know.
Yeah.
And then the treatments, which I thought were, you know, a lot of mistreatments.
Yes, yeah, so especially with the reptilians, you said.
Yes, yes. And you know the
reptilians. Well, would there be a good and evil here in the reptilians or the evil? I know you perceive them as that.
I perceive the reptilians as very, very evil. And They were in my life up until last year.
And what happened? How did you get rid of them?
I haven't gotten rid of them. I may not have.
You're not sure.
I'm not sure.
So far, so good.
So good, yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes. During that conversation with the boss, Ray, I even asked him if we all believe and have the same supreme being, how is it that you have the right to abduct earthlings? What gives you the right if you love your supreme being, which is my supreme being? What gives you the right to harm us and take us whenever you want? I never got the answer.
Maybe some of them believe in supreme beings and some don't, and maybe he's really evil. You know, I don't know. It's just, you don't really have all of the answers, but
no.
Writing this book, I'm sure, is therapeutic in a way, probably.
It was healing as I wrote each section of the diary. It's basically a diary. And last year I did begin writing the sequel to Morning Glory.
And when do you think you might finish that? I know you've had a lot of personal experiences that have slowed you down, so.
Hopefully soon. I had made the promise to many of the people that I would have it for this festival. But,
Well, maybe by next year.
Yes.
And we're going to stay in contact with you, and you let us know when that's available.
So I sure will.
Tell everybody.
I sure will. I also wanted to share with you that last year, even because of the book coming out, I had a film producer contact me, and I was in his movie, and the movie is about me, and I don't know if you know Mr. Al Bulick. The name of the movie is called The Hidden Hand. Now, why I wrote the book and decided to be in this movie is because I want to help other abductees who might be today in that same situation that I was in 1988. If I can reach them through a book and now the movie to help them, to understand and to know. Also, to reach other people who do not believe in this phenomena. And also, hopefully, it will answer questions to all the others who are not abductees, but who are very interested in this phenomena. And I have, so far, have succeeded in my wishes that I set out to do. Because I have received so many letters, phone calls, and I have helped all the gifts, all the love of gifts that I received during this time. I felt it was time to give back. I wanted to give back to this community. So I became a hypnotherapist working with alien abductees, and it has been so rewarding.
So someone could contact you that might need the hypnotherapy?
Oh, yes, yes. And they only don't get hypnotherapy. They get my understanding, my love, and my hug, which they need.
Yeah, I understand.
And I don't let go.
It's been a very inspiring and just emotional hour here with you, and we're almost out of time. But I got a couple of other questions. The abductees, were there any men involved?
Yes.
I wonder what they're doing with them. Same thing?
Taking semen. Because I was trained after I had asked about, you know, the creation, the supreme being, this mean boss, life changed for me then. They took me and began teaching me the technologies, their technology of bio and bio warfare and chemical warfare. And chemical stuff, okay, medical. And from that point in time is when I'm also what you call a mill lab abductee, meaning a fracture of our government and military. I should say also governments, because this is also worldwide.
Yes.
Okay, yes, yeah. They began abducting me as well now. and I am more friendly.
Right. Well, we've you have something in common with your friend Leah Haley.
Yes, that
basically.
Yes,
it's based on the same thing.
Yes. Very
the government people follow right along after them and doing even worse things.
Right, yes, yes.
It's just incredible.
Yes, but from all this now and because of a hybrid daughter that I love, that I've been with so very many times.
You do see this hybrid daughter?
Yes, I do. Her name is Winshaw. And
Where is she most of the time? Aboard the ship?
On the mother's ship, yes. I have not seen her about a year and a half now.
How old would she be now?
I would think maybe around 19 years old. They grow a lot quicker than our normal earthly children, our babies. They tend to grow quicker.
You mean mature?
Mature, okay, yes. All of them I find to be very, very, very intelligent, all the species. Are very far intelligent.
But is she aware that you...
Yes, that I'm her mother. Yes, yes, yes.
So there is that bond.
Yes, there is that bond.
On both sides.
Yes. And like I have had many hybrid children as well. And I remember the first hybrid child that they actually removed from me. They allow the female, when they implant you, you know, with a fetus, with the sperm mm-hmm. and what have you, gestation period is normally around 3 months. So they removed one hybrid baby from me, and a baby that is a little bit larger than my hand. They come, the lady, I suspect she is a lady because she had like... her hair, she had a little bit of hair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so weird. And just because of her actions, I felt, or maybe it was just me, but I took her as a female. She brought this little tiny, tiny baby for me to hold. And all I did, wanted to do, was just open my arms and let that this ungodly little creature fall. I mean, it had the big eyes. It looked part like me, and it looked part them.
Mm-hmm.
And this little, with her eyes just looking at me, the motherly instinct came over, and I just, they want you to nurse the hybrids.
Really?
Yes. So I just, you know, held her closer, and the motherly instinct took over, and I cried dearly when they took her away. I don't know if it was a little male or female, but when they took this little mm-hmm. being away. And
why do you think that they let the mothers see these hybrid children?
The emotion.
They
are trying to regain
emotions.
They lost how to love, how to care, how to really understand. And that's what they're trying to get back. And with the hybrid babies, what they're trying to do is a hybrid baby one day with all these hybrid children is to bridge other worlds and our world together to be as one.
And so we're not talking about a new world order, we're talking about a new universe order.
A new universe order, yeah, yes.
Besides the reptilians, which you have discussed and hate and dread to even talk about, how do you feel about the others?
Now I can understand. I'm not afraid.
In other words, you've accepted.
I have accepted, yes. Every time that I am taken now, there is other jobs normally that I do with our government. I just briefly discussed some of these jobs in the book,
mm-hmm.
but it has gone further than that. I don't know if I'm going to feel safe in writing about these so-called, quote, jobs that I am assigned to do.
You mean like our government?
Yes,
asking
our
you to do, government. To do, telling you to do something.
Yes, it's highly, I guess you'd say, unclassified.
danger.
After, well, they did threaten me, and they did threaten my life. It was not my life they took. It was my husband's life they
I'm
took.
I'm very sorry to hear about that. The last time I talked to you, he was very ill.
Very suddenly, with a very rare, aggressive, fast-growing, cancerous brain tumor. And the doctor waited until after he passed to tell me that his whole brain was nothing but tumor. Why? This is under investigation with some main researchers, because 2 months after he passed, another couple, man and lady, they won't give me the names or where this couple live. She also lost her husband a week before my husband passed. The very same,
same way.
Very quickly.
And you suspect this is coming from the government rather than the ETs?
Yes. And another couple, after my husband passed, the week after, she lost her husband in the very same manner.
Were these other people?
They were alien nil lab abductees.
And you think this is a threat from the government? Just don't talk anymore, huh?
Yes. Don't do what you're doing. But they're not going to win. They took my love away from me, and now I'm going to fight them. I'm going to talk, even if it means my life. I'm going to talk. I'm going to help.
How does your family feel about this, your daughters? They probably understand in a way. Maybe, I mean, one of them's been abducted at least.
Yes. In fact, I've had two children, and then my husband had also been abducted.
See, I understand what you're saying, and that's the reaction I think I would have. Nobody would know until a tragedy like that happens. But I don't think they would teach me a lesson. I think
they made me angry enough to go forth. They took my husband away from me, and I'm going to continue on. They're not going to shut me down.
We want to help you as much as we can. Anything we can
do
on that investigation, you let us know.
Thank you. I sure will. Thank you ever so much. Thank you.
I believe you're probably right on, unfortunately, about it all. Thanks very much, Gloria. We'll be in touch.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll truly appreciate it. We'll be talking again, and we want to help you on this government intimidation part. We may not be able to do much about the ETs.
Right.
Yeah.
But with the human being, you can.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Thanks very much, Gloria.
Thank you so much.
We have many, many shows with experiencers, people who say they have come in contact with ETs and UFOs, on our website at jerrypippin.com. Click on the UFO Files button at the top, and you'll see an index in which it says UFO Researchers. It's the first window. You click on there, and there's probably out of 60 or 70 shows, 20, 25 of them involve people who have had experiences. It's all on demand. Finally, we're going to touch on a little bit of a show we did with Nancy Talbert many years ago, when we were first on the internet from KBIX Radio in Muskogee, my hometown. And we came back and started doing our shows so we could be on the internet. And it became quite successful. Obviously, we're still doing it many, many years later. Nancy Talbert's going to tell an eyewitness story here. We can't play the whole show. We don't have enough time. But we do have it on our website. You click on that window I was talking about and her picture, and you can hear the show. But listen as she describes what she saw. A crop circle being created by a UFO.
And I went upstairs, and I was staying in a bedroom that overlooks the back of the house again and this field, which is immediately behind it. I hadn't been up there 2 or 3 minutes, gotten into my nightgown, I was in the bed reading, with these floor-to-ceiling glass doors that overlook a small balcony wide open because of the heat. I heard, all of a sudden, cattle in a barn nearby begin to bellow. Now, from talking to farmers and ranchers for years, at crop circle sites, I have learned that their animals frequently get very noisy, carry on, when crop circles occur. Not always, but frequently. The minute I heard these cattle, I've been there in this house many, many, many times, I'd never heard the cattle. I knew they were there, but I'd never heard them. And the noise they were making, it was clear they were agitated. And I had this feeling that I was going to, that something was getting ready to happen. I had an instinct to get up and go and stand in these doors because I could see the whole thing. And then immediately, some sort of intuition told me not to do that. And so the cattle became quiet again. I kept on reading. And then the cattle started up again, perhaps 10 minutes later. This time, very aggressively. It was very obvious that something was up. And again, I thought I should get up and stand in these windows and I'd see the whole thing. And for some reason, I didn't. Well, within minutes of the cattle quieting down the second time, suddenly there was this tube or column or shaft of brilliant, brilliant white light that came screaming down from above, right in front of these windows, lit my bedroom up like daytime, lit the outside. I could see a quarter of a mile, half a mile across this field. I could see the leaves on the trees. It was as bright. I've never seen anything quite that bright. And somehow this tube, which was perfectly straight all the way down, you know, I could see it against all this other light. Inside the tube, I saw a spiraling motion. This lasted for only a second or two, and then it went dark. There was no sound, no smell, no electrical charge. It was as if nothing had happened. Before I could move, within just seconds, one or two, another tube of light came screaming down. This whoop! Lit the room up, lit the outside up. This dramatic energy. By this time, I'm wondering if the kid is downstairs. I'd left him down in the kitchen, which has windows facing the same direction. And, of course, I'm thinking, you know, is Robert seeing this? Before I could get out of bed to start yelling for him, a third column came down. And the same thing, lit everything up like daylight. It lasted only for a second or two and then disappeared. By now, I was out of the bed yelling for him. He was running up the stairs yelling for me because he just witnessed the whole thing from the downstairs windows. From my vantage point, it was so bright, I couldn't see precisely where this tube was touching. But from his, he could see that it had touched down, they had touched down in this field immediately behind the fence at the end of his backyard. That's about 90 feet away from the edge of the house. So we went immediately to the doors, and the first thing we did was look up to see, you know, where these tubes of light were coming from. And there was absolutely nothing up there. And as far as we could see, it was, oh, there were a few clouds in the sky, but we could see the stars, and there was nothing that we could see from which these tubes of light had emanated. We wanted to go immediately to the fence to see. We thought there probably was going to be a new crop circle, but we were a little scared that if we stepped outside, we were going to get zapped, you know, that it might not be done. And Robert was braver than I. He finally, 30 seconds later or so, he did go out. And when he didn't get zapped, I went ahead and went out too. We went immediately to this fence at the back of the house. And I had a flashlight, and we shined it over into the field, which, by the way, was in string beans. And there, still smoking, the dew still evaporating, I mean, the mist from that, the steam, still coming off the plants, was a brand new crop circle that hadn't been there, you know, just minutes before. Now, in that case, it was an ellipse of about 30, 35 feet in diameter with a pathway going off the northern side and a crossbar like the capital letter T. It was in string beans. I've never heard of one in string beans before, but it was. And the plants were absolutely undamaged. They were simply bent over at the base, swirled around in this ellipse, and then one straight pathway heading north and, you know, this crossbar with no damage to the plants and no damage to the beans at all. Now, in that case, I know planks and boards were not the answer. I don't have any way to explain what I did see, what Robert saw. We both saw the spiraling motion. We both saw the tubes of light. We both saw that they were coming from nowhere. And we don't know how to explain that.
And there was no sound.
No sound, no smell. The second it was over, you would never have known it occurred if you hadn't been watching. A good 10 minutes, 12 minutes prior, they had been clearly agitated. They were now quiet, you know, no noise from them whatsoever. The next day, we went to the farmer who owned the cattle to see if he had heard them also, and he had, and also to see if they were all right, and they were fine. He had not gotten up. He had heard them and, you know, just had not gotten up.
Nancy Talbert, a unique story about a unique experience, seeing a crop circle form. That's it for our UFO show. This is Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. Until next time, cheers.